Session number 17183, Roman Halter, Reel 5, followed after a pause by Reel 6. Left channel is informant's microphone only, right channel combination of left and right.
Roman Halter, Reel 5.
Yes, our journey to Lodge Ghetto took a long time. I don't remember now how long, whether it was 2 days or so, but we were shunted to sites in various places. And really, we had no idea where we were going. Having seen my friends being massacred, I was positive that we are going to be taken somewhere. We are going to be killed. And all this vision of that past, of the murder, lay in the back of my mind. And all the time I felt that, was it a truth that I should share with any members of my family? But I did not. Then eventually we came, and somebody said, this is Lodge Ghetto, and at least that's a part of Lodge where the ghetto is. I had no idea what it meant. And the place was Marishin. And we were all kept on the train, and various people from Lodge came out and went and came out and went. And my father spoke to them. The other person on the train also was Shlamik's wife and her son. Somehow in the last moment she came to Hodesh, and she came with us. She knew that her husband was hung, and that little boy was very fond of me, and of course I was then the young uncle of his. And she was very enterprising. She's small that she was. She went out and sort of pulled all the strings that she could in order for us to get into the ghetto. It seemed suddenly that only a proportion of us would be taken off. And at one stage, they were sorting us out on the sidings of that railway. This part of Marishin was where the coal used to come and very heavy goods into Lodz. And then suddenly they decided to take us all into a school which was on Marishin. And we were taken there and crammed into various classes. And then suddenly there was a selection from all of us who came from Hodesh, 300 and something. I don't remember the exact figures, but it was 360 from all the 800. And only about something like 120 or so were put aside, and the rest were taken back to another train. It was quite heartbreaking, but things were getting completely abnormal because the school was overcrowded, and the people who were packed together in various classes and had to live and sleep there with their belonging, that was quite inhuman. There were not enough toilet and sanitation there. We then, after the selection, were left there for a time. And then we were put into little shacks there on Marishin, because there was no space in the ghetto, and they said we have to stay there for a while till space is allotted. And the ration became suddenly very meager, very tight, and we have had a very tough time there. And I remember that when the last few beans were cooked, and my mother said, this is the last of the beans, and I really ate one by one each bean, and I realized what it meant. And Shlamik's wife went in the meantime and met some people and did various things, and she was quite extraordinary, because we were one of the first to be allotted a space. And the space was in a prefabricated timber structure where we had roughly the size of, I don't know, about 10 feet by 6 feet. And we were at the very beginning of the timber structure, so other families had to go through us to enter the other places. So this little space was for my mother, myself, and Eva. She arranged, because my father was over 60, that he could go to a home for elderly, so could my grandfather. And she said that they would have a better time there than being in our little room. It was very hard for us to part, because we felt this is the beginning of the end. And she managed to get us these starvation rations, and life began inside the Lodz ghetto for us. And very soon we lost lots of weight, and I used to go to visit my father and my grandfather. My grandfather, very soon afterwards, within a month or month and a half, developed a cold. And when I came to visit him, it was easier for me to talk to him than to my father. My father lingered back to the hanging of his son, eldest son, to Shlamek, to the loss of the family, to being uprooted from the community, and to the loss of the whole community, because he took part in Chodesh as a member of the Jewish community vis-a-vis other communities there, that's the German and the Polish. Because he had a strong feeling that we were Poles, we were Jews, the other Poles were Christians, the other Poles were Protestants, and we all shared the life in a little town of Chodesh, and he felt that the whole thing has been turned upside down. And he never came down to my level of talking. I was 13, because he felt perhaps it's too sad for me or too much for me. So it's simply that from our ration, which was very meager, we managed to scrape away certain things in order to pass it on to him, because suddenly, within a very short time, these people over 60 had a even more meager ration than we. And the people there in the home started dying very quickly of starvation. My grandfather realized that this is not a life for him. And when I came along one day, although he was then sort of having pneumonia almost, he was quite ill, but he was very lucid in his mind. He said to me, you know, this is the murder of our people, of Jewish people. And this life here in ghetto is not for me. I'm fairly old now, and you must not be upset. I'll say goodbye to you. And you see that I am buried in the way that Jewish people are buried, and you say the Kaddish for me. And I said, don't talk like that, grandfather. He said, no, it's true. You must listen to me. And you remember when you were very small, I had this pocket watch which chimed. I'd like you to have it now, and that will remind you of me. And it was one that you press and the lid open. And then I told him about the massacre of my friends. And he said, when you survive, not if you survive, when you survive, you must tell the world exactly what happened, because such barbarities never occurred before in history, and people will not believe it. And I have to jump now to a certain part, because when Speer came out from Spandau prison, and his department was responsible for giving our metal factory, where I worked later on, a piece of paper that we should use as slave labor to pass on to factory part. One day he telephoned me, and I thought it was a Legpool that was one of my friends, and he said, Mr. Halter, this is Albert Speer. You wrote to me that my department gave a piece of paper. You asked me whether I did this. It was my department, really, that you should be used as slave labor. I would like to meet you. And I was quite taken aback by this. And then he said I told him, no, I really would not come to your home to break bread with you. So he said, well, we meet on neutral grounds in Strasbourg. So I said, let me think about it, and I'll write you. And I thought about it, and I said that I don't hold ordinary German responsible for what happened, but he was part of the hierarchy of the German leadership. He was very close to Hitler. He was part responsible for it. And my grandfather said, you shall speak about it very clearly. We are being murdered. And I would not come to his home or break bread with him. And I have this letter, and I have the letters which he wrote to me. And I said, in no way would I come to see you. Then he wrote back saying, but I have for my sins served so many years in Spandau. And I felt really that I had no stomach to carry on a correspondence with him. My memory of what my grandfather told me was more precious than really having polemics with Albert Speer. So my grandfather then thought, when you come next time, and if I have something important to tell you, I'll write it down so that you should remember. And when I came next time, he was dead. And at that time, there was still a group that collected the dead people and took them. The cemetery was also in Marishin, where the train arrived. It was a very impressive, still is a very impressive cemetery, because the very rich people before the war in Lodz Ghetto built palaces to themselves when they died. And there was the family Poznański, who had enormous tombs. It was out of white marble, sent especially from Carrara. The Jews in Lodz were very rich. But his grave was very impoverished. My father was too weak to go to the burial, and just my mother and I went. And she was very upset, naturally, because her father died, and she was very close to him and respected and loved him. And as promised, I said the Kaddish. I didn't know it off by heart, because my teaching was not so precise as other boys who learned parrot fashion. So I read this from the book. And I felt he would understand that, because he was my teacher. And I found that the little plaque there, the little thing, was so insignificant. So I always liked the calligraphy that he once taught me, so I made it on a piece of wood, a better plaque, because the winter started setting in and became very cold. My mother decided to chop up the furniture. We had a sort of round timber stove and burn this. So instead of, we sat on the bed, and I kept a piece of furniture in order to make this plaque for my grandfather. And I managed, it was not very easy to get the necessary paint for it. Then my father became weaker and weaker, and our starvation became greater and greater, to such an extent that after the winter of 1940-41, which was very severe, we had to dress to go to bed so that we shouldn't freeze, because there was ice not only on the window, but ice on the walls. And had we not had this wonderful eiderdown, we would not have survived. Eva, although she was registered that she was living with us, she found a man with whom she lived there. And her son became very ill, and he was in hospital on Wagiewnicka. And I wanted to visit him, but she said, no, you mustn't. I wasn't allowed to go to see him. I don't know what the illness was, and he also died. And only very occasionally did Eva come and visited us. She found that now her husband was dead and her son was dead. She slightly detached herself from us. She found a job in a soup kitchen. And now and again, when our starvation became very severe, I used to go there and ask her if she could help us. So she gave us, or she gave me, which I brought home, a bag of potato peelings. They were very thin peelings, but my mother used to wash them again. And with caraway seed and various other bits of things, she used to grind them together. And there was a communal guest kitchen where each person living in this particular area was allotted a certain time of guest ring. And on that she steamed that. And before my father died, when he came, we used to keep a piece of that potato peeling cake, so to say, for him. And then the last time that he came in spring of 41, we had nothing to offer him except salt, and we three of us sat on the bed and licked salt. And we had so little to say to one another, we all sort of enwrapped in sadness. And one day I came there and he was dead. And he left a note that his heavy coat, which he brought with him, I should take with me, and was still there, and that should be made into a coat for me. And I went along. My mother was very weak and very upset, and arranged for him to be buried. And he was taken to Marishin, to the morgue. Then he was kept there in the morgue. The burial society, the man working there in Marishin, the cemetery, said to me, "We'll bury him, providing you give us some of your bread ration." And our bread ration was so small. So I said, "Sorry, we just cannot." So he said, "Well, in which case, here's a spade we'll lend you, but bring it back and you bury him." And it's 624 plot. So I went there because they were numbered, these graves, and saw this and started digging. And then I went back and told my mother. I had to return the spade, then came back and told my mother. That was on 26th day of Iyar. That's the Hebrew months, 1941. And I told my mother that what is happening, and she came along. It was a very long way for her because she was quite weak. And I dug the grave, and then they gave me a metal bed, which is the bottom part of a bed with four legs, on which you put a mattress on. And she said, "What you do is you drag this along." So she, my mother and I, put my father on this metal bed, but she couldn't help me, so I rotated him. It took a long time. I swiveled it round, went round the other side, swiveled round. And eventually, I managed to get it to the grave, and then dug a little bit more, and rested, dug a little bit more. And the grave wasn't very deep, and I put my father in, and we buried him. My mother, by that time, her upset was so great that she had no tears. And both of us, we stood there looking at one another and looking at this grave and looking at the 624. And I said, "One day soon I'll make him a plaque." And we walked back. And I had to drag this bed back, and she carried a spade and gave it back. And these people whose duty was to bury did not react because they were already immune to this. And it was still very cold. The days changed between cold, not so cold. 26th day of year is just the break of spring. That winter before my father died, I had a sort of tough luck in one instance. I found that little boys were making briquettes out of coal dust. And because we needed fuel and we burned our wood, I found how they make these briquettes. So I went there to dig for the coal dust. And my wooden cloppers, which I had there, were a bit too tight. My big toe froze. And it started smelling. It became sort of almost gangrenous. So I went to a local hospital. It was a very nice doctor. And he said, you bite this piece of rag and I'll cut this white skin off, because otherwise you will die. It will infect you. And then I'll sterilize it. And let's hope that the bandage will heal you. You seem strong and will eventually heal. And he very nicely did this operation while I bit this rag and disinfected, put it, and it healed. And he said, there's a Polish way of making, instead of sock, a piece of rag that you wrap around. It's called onutska. And he said, ask some people how to do this and tear up any rags that you have and wrap it around your foot, because then it's much looser than the sock and that will heal better and will allow air to get in. And so I learned how to do this, and I managed to get a pair of bigger clogs by swapping my grandfather's watch. It was I was very sorry to part with it, but my mother said, really, it's more important that than you die. And this rag, it's a sort of square rag that you wrap round and you slip your foot in. It's a Slav way of doing this. Russian soldiers used to put it in boots, and Polish peasants used to do that. And I learned how to do it without having knots underneath. And that healed. It healed, and I was all right. But then we heard that factories are being started in Lodz Ghetto, and that Himmler came along and complimented Rumkowski, who was head of the eldest of the Jews. And apparently there was a Jewish council that was formed, and the SS came together with Bibov and Czarnula and said, who is the eldest here of the Jews, the eldest of the Juden? And Rumkowski, who was the oldest in age, stood up and said, I am. He misunderstood. And so they said, you are head of the Jews in Lodz Ghetto. You are the eldest of the Juden. And so he became the head of Lodz Ghetto. And Lodz Ghetto started getting organized into factories. And my mother found out that the metal factory was his beginning, and because I had dexterous fingers, she took me along there and they took me on. So I started first in the engraving department, and there were very able young people there, youngsters, who were so good at it. Mr. Glazier was head of it. He had a son, Mietek, who is still living in Israel now. Mr. Glazer also survived, but he's dead now. And I worked in the engraving department first. And later on, this engraving department were making the Lodz Ghetto money. But of course, I was very, very much down in the skill of making the plates. The others were so much better at it. The metal factory was headed by somebody called Himovich, Joseph Himovich. And he was a very charismatic man. He looked a little bit like Maxwell in his heyday. And I have a photograph really from Lodz Ghetto, taken beginning of 44, where he's standing there in breeches, and he spoke German perfectly, and he looks very imposing. And he came in when I was interviewed, and he said, how old are you? Where are you from? What do you like to do? And I told him that I like writing and drawing. And that was it. His brother was a section leader, Leon. At a certain stage, when I worked in this metal factory, people were selected to be sent off to do some engraving, and they had to be very skilled, and I failed the test of being sent on. These people were sent on to make £5 notes. They never returned. None of them survived. And I was rejected. And being rejected in that part, I was demoted to another section in the metal factory. And I was in the section under Leon Himovich, the brother of the head of the factory. Most people there were very skilled. At first, we're doing like metal plates for boots for soldiers, drilling and countersinking them once they were pressed out. The presses were hand presses, and one just puts the strip of metal and pulled that handle, and that pressed out the metal plate. Then the metal plates were put on a wooden pattern and countersunk by young boys, and there were many young boys who worked there. Again, there are photographs in the Wiener Library of these young boys who worked in metal factory. My mother found work in another factory, which these factories were called a resort. I don't know why, but perhaps in German small factories are called resorts, but she found work in another factory. And the advantage suddenly we found was that the people who worked in factories as a reward received a soup at lunchtime. And without that soup, one couldn't survive. In fact, the rations became so minuscule that starvation and existence could only be maintained by having that soup, by working in a factory. And despite the soup, my mother became weaker and weaker. And she started getting swellings on her legs. And it meant crossing a wooden bridge from one area to another. And that bridge was very high, very many steps. And I used to help her to get across. And then I used to go to metal factory there. And on the way back, I also used to make a point of meeting her by a bridge and helping her across. And not that other people wouldn't help, but it's... It was like traveling in Italy when the carriages are overcrowded and people become irritated and agitated, that everybody is centered on their family, on their children, on their survival, that there was no time of empathy and caring about others. Yet some people did care about it. It was Germans were fully aware that they created this condition of overcrowding and this condition of struggling for survival and this condition of getting any little bit of extra food. And so one could not expect that by helping you, they weakened themselves. They were busy with their lives. And the ghetto was organized in a way that it functioned, it worked. And the people in charge of the Lodz ghetto structured in a way that they had Jewish police, Jewish fire brigade, Jewish factories. Everything was run by the Jews. But the SS knew what the pulse of the ghetto was. And they also trained various people who were denouncing in case somebody was plotting something. And these people disappeared very quickly. They set up also a cripple very close to Kościelne, that big church there behind it. And that was really for defleecing people who were sent to the Lodz ghetto. And people were sent to the Lodz ghetto from all over Europe. And the gold and the valuables were taken away. They used to be invited, so to say, to cripple, to come along. And sometimes they didn't reappear from the cripple. And all that they had hidden, all they had buried, was found and taken away. And so the dual function of the Germans was to make the factories and also to rob the Jews and keep them on a starvation level and slowly deplete them and murder them. The committee, the way I understood from the Lodge Ghetto,